I was born with this brain and I still have this brain and I will always have this brain. And I was born autistic and ADHD, and it took me 39 years to realize that. I'm just trying to get to, what am I best at? When am I best at it? And therefore, if I can find those two things, we will be most useful to my team and my projects.
Welcome to the Mojo Podcast. I'm Richard Stokes, and this season, we're exploring Mojo Under Fire, those crucible moments that either break us or forge us into the leaders others want to follow. Each episode, I sit down with people who face their defining moment, the crisis, the setback, the dark night, and found something unexpected on the other side. Not tips and tricks, but honest conversation about what it really takes to lead from the inside out. If you're looking for polish, this isn't it. If you're looking for truth, welcome. My guest today is Ben Branson, multi-times a founder, father of three, and recently diagnosed autistic and ADHD. Ben is a leader of movements in non-alcoholic drinks, in nature, and now in neurodiversity. This episode is something of a catch-up for us, as it's been 5 years since Ben first appeared on the podcast. And suffice to say, a lot has happened in that time to further develop his leadership in the lab, in the home, and in the office. This conversation is full of wisdom and story, and many takeaways for you. I loved it, and I hope you love it too. Okay, let's dive in. Ben Branson, welcome back to the Mojo Podcast. So good to see you again.
Yeah, it's nice. I don't really think I've been back on people's podcasts before. Yeah, very, very pleased to return. And as you reminded me, 5 years.
5 years since we recorded.
Yeah.
As I was just saying, it was quite a momentous day in many ways. It was C-Lip's fifth birthday that very day. So I was hugely appreciative that you took the time to talk to me. And we were both reflecting on, it was the day after Trump had been voted in for the first time in the States.
One. And were we in a lockdown? Obviously COVID was going on, wasn't it? November 2020.
It was in that funny phase. I think we were just out of lockdown before that first Christmas, which didn't really happen. Obviously, I was in Ibiza, which I still am. So I was experiencing a bit differently to the UK. But you were talking about how, I certainly remember it, how you'd reorged around Seedlip and moved people's roles around an awful lot and been, you know, very fleet of foot in terms of what you needed to do to survive.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, as everybody did, I guess, a lot of quick thinking and pivots and, adapting. That feels like a really long time ago to me. A lot longer than 5 years, but...
Yeah, doesn't it? I think we've all grown, hopefully, a lot in that time. But Ben, I always start with this question. So give yourself out of 10 today, right in this moment. What's your mojo like right now?
Out of 10 today, and we're talking on a Monday, at this time, usually my Mondays I find hardest, actually. But I'd say I'm having a pretty good day today. So I'd go for like an 8, 8.5.
Great. So that's a relative, certainly for a Monday, that's a relatively high score.
Yeah, it's a... Yeah. Literally just before we jumped on, I had a text from an investor who's potentially in for £150,000 of our 2 million round, and we've only got 15% left to raise. So that's nice. I've hired a new assistant who joins me on Wednesday, and that was confirmed this morning. We've had a couple of good wins this morning on just some packaging elements for one of our brands. And I just, I sort of work from home. Our distillery is where I live. So I've just managed to go make a coffee and say hello to my wife quickly in the middle of the day, which she was quite surprised about. And then we get to chat again. So, yeah, what's not to like?
Yeah, well, what I love about hearing your news, but also recognizing even the small wins in life. I mean, investor news, obviously big, but there's... Coffee with my wife, a wonderful thing just to lift that sense of where you're at.
Yeah, and I guess in this sort of game of snakes and ladders, which is certainly how I view startup businesses and small projects, all those wins can, add up and make a massive difference. I'll any of those bits of momentum, because that's all they are. They're just good signals that things are moving, hopefully in the right direction. Yeah, that's huge wins.
Yeah, so I love that, taking all that on board, signals of momentum. And I also, you know, the only other question I always ask to my guests is, so your own take on the word mojo, obviously you answered this a few years ago. Has it shifted? Is it the same? Just to say, you did mention Austin Powers to me 5 years ago, which is fair enough. It's probably in popular culture.
Yeah, I'd probably say it's shifted. I think, you know, 5 years ago, I'd not been diagnosed autistic and ADHD. I'd only, you know, relatively recently, you know, 12 months ago, so back to 2019, sold the majority of Seedlip, which was my big project. And I hadn't properly kicked off the three projects that I'm working on now. So yeah, I am different to 2020. And I guess how I define mojo, I do look at it I try and keep it quite simple, Rich, in the sense that I am either having a really good day or I'm not interested. And I tend not to have mediocre days. Not that the bad days are, you know, everything's gone wrong and they're dreadful. But I am someone who's either like, I'm fully into it and I'm feeling it and things are happening and there's momentum. Or I'm slightly disengaged, or for some reason, whether it's I didn't get any sleep because of my kids, or I don't know, just things aren't chiming and I don't feel like I'm in the flow of things. And I just have learned to try and not do anything important, if possible, when I don't feel great. That's as simple as I've made it. And then to make hay, like if things are going well, like you lean in on that and go for it.
Yeah, love it. You mentioned flow last time, and it sounds like as you said, you know, 5 years, a long time, a lot of learning and awareness, diagnosis since then. So it feels like you're a lot clearer about yourself when you're in that high mojo day. Here's the flow, get it all done, chuck more at me.
Yeah.
You know what? It's just not happening. So I'm going to disengage either deliberately or not, and kind of wait for the mojo to come back again.
Yeah. And it doesn't mean I stop working, but it does mean I do different things.
Yeah.
And so I'm not going to make big decisions when I'm not feeling great. I'm not going to, I don't know, send important emails or have important calls when I'm not feeling great. And obviously it doesn't always work out like that, in being that kind of simplistic. But yeah, I do think I've learned to, I guess I've probably learned more in the last, certainly in the last 3 years, about when I am at my best and what are the conditions I need to be at my best. And some of that is the environment I'm in. Some of that is the people I'm working with. Some of that is the projects I'm working on. And some of that is the things I'm doing on those projects. And so it's sort of I don't know, it's not like I don't spend ages kind of analyzing all of this. And I don't have it in a spreadsheet and I don't have it in a plan. But yeah, I'm just trying to get to, what am I best at? When am I best at it? And therefore, if I can find those two things, we will be most useful to my team and my projects. And so I always think about capacity. I'm always thinking about, how can I get out the way? How can I not slow things down? How can I give people more responsibility and accountability? Yeah, I have this healthy fear that I'm slowing things down because I'm getting in the way. And so, yeah, the only inbox I have that is at zero 99% of the time is my Slack inbox. because that's my team. And so if they need something from me or we need to make a decision, I don't want any of that hanging around. My other inboxes are a bit of a mess. My Slack inbox is always like cleaned down, up to date, on top of, because it's for my team.
Yeah, I love that. And yeah, you know, I love the clarity of, you know, we're going to talk broadly about leadership in here and, you know, things that have shaped your leadership. But that clarity of, I love that, you know, what I'm best at and when I'm best doing it, and just really laser focused on that. I just think straight off the bat, so many people listening, I'm sure, will tune into that and go, right, okay, yeah, that's a great reflective question for me. Now, where do I want to be?
I'm only really, really good at a few things, right? And I can't speak for anybody else. As I, you know, I'm 42 now, and I guess I've sort of been in drinks for 12 years, and I'm only really starting to fully be able to appreciate that there are a few things that I'm really brilliant at, and they are real assets to my team, my businesses, and our charity. And so how can I spend as much of my time doing those things that I'm really brilliant at, and outsourcing, delegating, partnering, with other brilliant people who are brilliant at the things that I'm not brilliant at. I mean, that sounds really, really simple, doesn't it? But I see this with my kids at school. Of you start to learn what your children are best at and great at and enjoy doing and what they find difficult. And the kind of received wisdom is, if they're not good at maths, they need a tutor. They need extra help.
Yeah, yeah.
And if they're brilliant at cricket or art or French, then just that's okay. That's good. But what about sorting out the things that they're not brilliant at? And I'm parenting in totally the opposite way. I'm like, our eldest is a drama scholar and she finds math difficult. We've never had a math tutor. She's never had any extra math lessons. Let's go see a play. Mm. You know, like let's watch a musical. Let's like do more drama stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think you can apply that to business. And I know, yeah, it's not new thinking around sort of experts versus generalists and, you know, how your team is made up, but I guess it's just top of mind for me at the moment as we're back at the beginning with our projects. They're small, with small teams, and yeah, therefore it's really top of mind for me at the moment.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I love that authentic strengths-based thinking and focus. Dive in on that. I tell you here, there's a cultural piece that definitely says, well, fill in the weaknesses gap. You know, first of all, call them weaknesses.
Sure.
And then try and play catch up, which is just not just naturally where we necessarily want to be and play. And on that, just you talked about the projects, and I'd love for you to just give us a snapshot, because we talked, there are broadly three, if you call them work-based projects, that are really going on at the moment, versus when we last spoke and it was Seedlip and it was one very clear focus. So I'd love to just hear about those and how that difference between, you know, a bit of a juggling act now of projects versus this single-minded focus of Seedlip.
Yeah. So there's lots of, you can read lots of things out there about, you know, do one thing well and, you know, be single-minded and, which I massively subscribe to. And that was part of me, I guess, starting out in the drinks industry. Seedlip was absolutely all consuming and we were starting a new category and it went very fast and very big. And I did give absolutely everything to that, and it needed kind of everybody's single-minded focus on it. I think what I'm trying to do now is hopefully with a little bit more learning and understanding, having done a drinks project before, is we've launched two new drinks projects. And one of them, Silver, which is an aged non-alcoholic spirit that we make here at our distillery. And that is all about, I mean, I've created a maturation process that uses wood, doesn't use barrels, and we use ultrasound and oxygen and pressure and time and temperature to effectively make dark non-alcoholic liquids that you can sip and slow down with. And the magic of that project, I guess the thing that I love so much about it, is we're working with the most underestimated raw material for flavor, wood and trees. And I mean, I can talk all day about trees, Rich, but there are 73,000 tree species. And I can tell you, because I've tasted over 250 of them, they are full of flavor. And wow, they are so diverse in terms of a source of flavor. Anyway, that has been challenging, building a distillery, figuring out a process, working with a new material. But, you know, we've just gone live on Ocado. We're in all these Michelin star restaurants, Selfridges, Berry Brothers, started at the top, very much like Seedlip. And the reaction and the response has been pretty amazing and pretty overwhelming and very positive. And we're doing something no one's done before. And we're building our second distillery in upstate New York at the moment to work with North American tree species and North American grain. And so that consumes a lot of my time, energy, emotion, learning, research. It's challenging, it's head scratching. We're doing lots of things for the first time. And it's so exciting.
And it's that one there, Ben, doing things for the first time, because that's definitely what, obviously, when we spoke previously, you know, Seedlip created a category out of nothing. And I remember people, you said the feedback was mixed. Some people said you're insane. Yeah. We talked about the importance of being deluded, doing something that people can't even contemplate doing. But here you are again. I get this sense of pioneering. And that drives you? I'm getting that sense that really drives you forward.
Yeah, I don't know. Silver as a project started for me before Seedlip. You know, consulting on a design project in the US in Kentucky with working with this old guy who had started using UV and ultrasound to match 12-year-old bourbon in 3 weeks. And I found that project absolutely fascinating. And so not long after Seedlip launched, I bought an ultrasound jewelry cleaner. And I put some wood chips in there and I put a bottle of Seedlip in there. And I learned I could make a liquid that was kind of yellowy and tasted a bit woody, and ultimately that ultrasound could be a way of extracting flavor and color from wood rather than it sitting in a barrel for years and years and years. And so that, you know, but Seedlip was all about botanicals. It kind of wasn't about aged spirits. And so I've learned this, you know, being autistic, I can be very, very patient and I can be very methodical and incredibly strategic and, yeah, very logical. And then being ADHD, I can be, that all goes out the window and let's just fucking do it. You know, let's get on with it. And so Silver has been, and part of the last 3 years has been understanding this push-pull and harnessing it and using it from a work perspective to, yeah, try and get my brain to work in harmony as much as possible and take the best bits of both those aspects. And so, yeah, Silver's actually, yeah, it's been a long time coming. And I'm not dramatizing when I say that what we've built 12 months in is a dream come true. Like it really is a dream come true. And, you know, you'll have heard me last time wax lyrical about how much I love nature and how much it means to me. And this is another opportunity where I get to learn about trees and I get to, yeah, learn about flavor and provenance and all the things that, yeah, regardless of drinks, just I get to learn. And so I definitely don't think in what can I do that no one's ever done before terms. And I don't think in what is the gap and what hasn't someone tried. I am, yeah, this does all happen quite organically for me. And, you know, Season, our second project, which is a pair of cocktail bitters, so like Angostura, that you dash into your drinks.
Yeah.
That started in 2017 for me. And that was led by, I experimented with 80 different ingredients, 80 different herbs, spices, to make different blends of cocktail bitters. So very strong, intense liquids that you add and can really transform or complete a drink or a cocktail. And we were doing that for events and giving some to bartenders, and it wasn't a business. There weren't any other things that we could use or find to work with the seedlip cocktails we were making. And so that was a gap, sure, but that was just an opportunity to kind of make something. And I guess I have learned that with everything that I do, I want to make something that changes something or that meets a need. And yeah, everything I'm doing doesn't feel like work because it's an expression of what I think and how I see the world and what's important to me. And that is I feel very privileged in a sense to kind of, well, not privileged because I don't know any other way, but it feels great. It feels great that everything I'm interested in, I get to work on.
Yeah. Look at that. Look what you've created. And that's, you know, I sort of scribbled down thinking about your creativity and coming from need, but this ability, this desire to create, as I say, not for because it hasn't been done before, because there's a requirement and I can go and fill it. And this sense of learning, I get this deep sense of the fulfillment of learning more and going literally deeper into nature.
I love my children. Like they, you know, I love my girls to bits, but I know I would know so much more if I didn't have children. You know, because I do know my projects and my family are the most important things in my life. I don't have friends. I don't have a social life. And I'm very boundaried with how I work. And so if I'm not kind of working on my projects, I'm with my daughters and my wife, right? And there's no real blur there. It's like I'm here and I'm with the kids. But, and you've got kids, so you know, Rich, A, you want to spend time with them, right? And B, that's quite a lot of time. And when they're young, they really need you, and you want to be there, obviously, but you want to, that takes up a lot of time. I don't wish it any other way, but I do know, because I can be blunt and logical, that my businesses, my projects would be bigger, faster. I'd learn more. I'd know more about trees if I spent more time on them. I don't wish it any other way, but that is, yeah, that's definitely the reality. And so there is a kind of, yeah, I'm voracious in my learning, and I'm driven by a lot of what if questions and a lot of curiosity and a lot of why do we chop a 100-year-old oak tree down to make two barrels that only can only hold about 3,000 bottles of liquid in their lifetime. Like, why do we do that? Why do we wait 10 to 20 years to see what that liquid's going to taste like? And why do we only use like a tiny little bit of the surface of the inside of the barrel rather than the actual wood? Anyway, those kind of, yeah. I guess, first principles sorts of questions. And it was the same with Seedlip, and it's definitely been the same with silver and with season, in terms of like, look, we season our food. We know salt and pepper, spices, etc., make things tastier. Like, what if we applied that to drinks? What if we could have even tastier drinks, really simply with a few dashes of lovely liquid?
I love that. Yeah, I love that question. The what if, the imagine if we did. And I think, you know, so much of life is we are somewhat on autopilot, somewhat blinkered in our thinking and in our doing. And then there are ways of unlocking that. And I'd love to, you know, come on to the third project, the hidden 20%. And specifically, you know, we've talked about it in passing already, but, you know, your diagnosis, autism and ADHD, as I understand it. And I'd love to, you know, take us back to when that happened and maybe why you got the diagnosis, because this was an adult diagnosis, not when you were a kid. So what drove it?
Yeah. So I mean, it's worth a couple of bits of useful context. One, I saw my first psychiatrist when I think I was 8. I've been sectioned twice. I've been in a number of different rehabs in my early 20s. I've been in therapy when I was in my 20s. I've seen a lot of professionals, mental health professionals. And not once, never ever, did anyone ever say anything around ADHD, autism. Ever. And so I grew up, as many of us did, with very limited beliefs about what autism is and what ADHD is, and very stereotypical Rain Man kind of views on autism, and that, you know, ADHD people were just kind of a bit off the wall, a bit hyperactive, people who couldn't sit still, probably little boys, not really adults, but just little boys. And, you know, that went through across dyslexia. Oh, that's just people who can't spell, isn't it? Or Tourette's, and that's just people who say inappropriate things. You know, very, very ignorant, very limited, stereotypical kind of views that I've since learnt, because of what we're doing, that those views are sadly shared by way too many people, and that we don't have a good up-to-date understanding of people's different brains. Anyway, so I then got to 39 years old, and I'd not seen anything in the press or media, and life was good. There was no crisis, there was no big kind of problem, but another guy in the drinks industry, he was diagnosed with autistic and ADHD, and I knew him. I always got on with him quite well. He came out kind of quite publicly in the drinks industry. And I was kind of like, okay, that's kind of interesting. And then probably about 6 months later, I was listening to someone on a podcast, and they were kind of talking a bit about autism and a bit about ADHD. And I started sort of relating to a bit of how they were thinking about themselves and how they were talking. And again, it was just like another sort of seed sown. You know, I think I was saying earlier, some things I can be really patient on, and they actually take quite a while to materialize. And I then just found myself, you know, doing a bit of Googling. And what is this autism thing? I was really focused on autism actually initially. And that led to, you can do like an online test, a little sort of screener. Okay, I've come out scoring quite highly on that. Nah, I can't be autistic. And so this was a process of, it was about a 9-month kind of dust settling, clarifying. I mean, meanwhile, this was, my wife was 8.5 months pregnant with our third daughter. That was going on at kind of the same time. And I just remember I called up the guy from the drinks industry and just said, Ian, I think I could be autistic. And he laughed. He's Irish. He's like, of course you are. And I said, who did you go and see? Because I think there's this massive waiting list for the NHS. And, I'm fortunate I could go privately. And so he put me in touch with Renata, the psychologist that diagnosed me. And that started a kind of 12-week process with her. And I didn't tell anyone. I didn't tell my wife. I didn't involve my family. I just wanted to know. I just wanted to kind of, it was an opportunity to kind of understand myself more. And of course, then, literally Renata said, congratulations, Ben, you're autistic. And then I realized I was the last to know when I told other people and no one was surprised. And that was I sat down with Heston Blumenthal on our podcast and he said exactly the same thing. And I sort of felt a mixture of, that's great that it's not a surprise to people because that's good. They are seeing you. And then also, but how did you not know? And then a tinge of sort of sadness around that of being the last to know. But regardless, it was the most liberating moment for me, I think, and the most empowering moment in the sense that it wasn't really about the word or the label or anything like that. It was somebody kind of going, here's some information that you can go and do something with, that you can look into, that could help you understand yourself more. And so it's a bit like being given a key and not necessarily showing the door where the door is, but at least you've got a key, you've got a chance, you've got an opportunity to go and look into this and process it all in terms of my past and how I work and the questions I had about how I work. I'm okay that I don't have friends, but that's not what society says is okay. That's not what dictates whether someone is a good person. A good person is someone who's popular and has lots of friends. Anyway, it set off a lot of hairs running. Mm-hmm. And then I got the ADHD diagnosis probably about 6 months later. But the really important thing that happened was because I like to learn things, I wanted to understand what was going on. I was like, how am I 39 and I've missed this? How rare, how many people are there like this? What's going on in society? Why is there so much stereotype? What do we know about this stuff? And I found two alarming and amazing things. One was that the statistics for lots of the dreadful things that can happen in life, really right from bullying at school or exclusion at school to mental health, addiction, eating disorders, unemployment, homelessness, divorce, disease, death. Autistics and neurodivergent people over-index on. We win. 8 out of 10 autistic adults are not in employment. 94% of autistic children are bullied at school. Really kind of quite alarming statistics. So that was one thing that I found out, and that was pretty shocking. And then this, on the flip side, all the people that I guess I kind of gravitate towards or look up to or idolize, and a lot of the things that I'm interested in, a lot of neurodivergent people are featuring. And so, whether it's, the kind of Steve Jobs, or it's, contributions to science from the kind of Darwins and Bells and Marie Curies. And there's that amazing Apple advert called 1984 called Think Different. Have you seen that?
I remember it well. Yeah.
Most of those people featured are neurodivergent or believed to be neurodivergent. And obviously Richard Branson, famously dyslexic. And I couldn't comprehend how there were these amazing skills and strengths and these and incredible creativity or discovery and wonderful contributions to the world. And yet we had on the other side all these dreadful things happening. And so wanted to try and close that gap and try and find some balance and some better public understanding that, you know, I don't have a disease. I'm not broken. I'm not deficient. I have a different brain. And that different brain means that some things I am way better than you at doing. And other things, you are way better than me. And some of those things can be very menial and very simple and very everyday. That everybody's got a different brain. Everybody has a different brain. And so we set up the charity called The Hidden 20%, based on the fact that our belief at the time was that 20% of the global population are neurodivergent. So that's 1 in 5. We're currently interrogating that number with a research project because we believe it's likely to be higher. We chose media. So we launched a podcast and a whole load of social and we release every week, and the numbers and the community and the impact and the emails we get has been really mind-blowing the last 2 years to kind of have I think our content reaches 4 million people a week, and we've got 225,000 kind of strong community. It's been brilliant. And to get the opportunity to sit down with, everyone from like neuroscientists to meeting heroes of mine, like Heston Blumenthal, to people on the front line, like running amazing organizations and doing amazing work or writing amazing books about this or researching this. We've just scratched the surface, Rich, but we just want to reframe this and tell the truth.
So many congratulations, Ben, for that, and what you're doing. And I get the sense of a movement. It feels like you're a leader of movements to me in many ways, whether it be around non-alcoholic drinks, nature, neurodiversity, and
three N's.
There we go. Easier to remember.
There you go.
And I've listened to a few episodes, and the one that absolutely hit me hardest, and I don't know if it'll be a surprise me saying this to you, is the one with your wife. That is an incredible, even calling it a piece of content seems just a bit trite, a conversation that is so brave and honest and raw. And if people are listening, please listen to that episode. I'm sure there are other fantastic ones as well, but that just struck me as a husband. As an incredible conversation to have with your partner. How was it just setting that up and doing it, and then the response to it?
It was an interesting one because we've now recorded, we've recorded two episodes, and one was, a few months in. And that was, we were both in bits on that one. And that was a lot about our relationship, how Sam has really struggled to really come to terms with me being autistic. I think she actually likes me being ADHD, but she struggles more with me being autistic, and the change that happened in our relationship around that. And then the second episode focused more on one of our daughter's diagnoses and how far we've come, and then talking about shutdowns and the shutdowns that I've experienced. And I didn't cry in that second one, but Sam did. But the emails that we, you know, Sam getting an email basically saying that because of our episode, a lady was about to walk out on her husband and didn't because of her getting some sort of renewed hope or understanding about her husband and their relationship from our episode. And yeah, we always used to say at CDIP, like, guys, look, it's non-out, it's drinks. We're not saving the world. We're not kind of changing the world, you know, in that sense. It's not life and death. But when neurodiversity is concerned, it kind of, as we're learning, it can be life and death. And it can be the difference between marriage and divorce. And yeah, I don't know, it's really tangible in that sense, and it's highly charged and it's highly personal. And I think Sam and I, I can't speak for Sam, but I think we both, there was nothing on there that we hadn't ever discussed before between us. But I think it's one of those things where it's like, we just want to do the right thing and want to be helpful. And so if we're going through this, the chances are probably quite high that there are other people going through this and in this situation. And I guess that there's an element of responsibility that comes with, all right, we've got an audience, we've built a kind of community. We take our credibility really, really seriously and the truth very seriously, because there's a lot of rubbish and a lot of misinformation out there. And so accuracy is very important to us. And it's brilliant when you hear, I find it interesting when you hear an expert talking, right? And someone unpacking like some research, or I find that interesting, but not everybody wants to hear expert, you know, information. Those personal stories and that kind of real experience where it's really genuine, people really do respond well to as well. So I think we've got kind of neuroscientists one week, and then we've got me and my wife crying the next week. And I think that's right to have both, rather than, who's this for, and what kind of content are you putting together? It's kind of like, no, we do episodes. We know we're not going to be big. We do. And people don't want to listen to an episode about suicide, and that's terrible, but it makes sense. But that's important for us to do for International Suicide Awareness Day, that we did an episode about suicide. Because if we were just doing it for the algorithm, we wouldn't do anything on dyslexia. We wouldn't do anything on suicide. We wouldn't do anything on the menopause. We wouldn't do anything on all, you know, associated kind of brain injury. We wouldn't do anything on those other niches. We would just do stuff on ADHD, basically. It just feels like it's an important one. And my middle daughter was diagnosed autistic nearly a year ago. Yeah, it's important. Example setting and role modeling for her to see that there's nothing wrong with her, and that she's got a wonderful brain, and she's going to grow up in a really different environment.
Yeah. And how do you reflect on, because we talked, you know, leadership in its broader sense, work, home, you as that leader, either at work or at home, now post diagnosis and having this understanding of, again, as we used the term earlier, my authentic strengths. I know these things that I'm really good at. And now, as you said, with a daughter also autistic, how do you notice yourself? Are you showing up differently? Are you, what's
yeah, I am. I am more myself than I've ever been. I don't I masked a lot, which I guess is the how can I appear to make lots of eye contact and appear to be sociable and appear to, yeah, not find any of this stuff difficult. And then, yeah, be absolutely exhausted. And I think all of our, you know, all of our social batteries, just as a massive big generalization, have changed. Like there is a shift, and COVID's part of that shift. Tech and social and stuff are all part of that shift as well. But socializing is changing, and how we spend our time is changing, and therefore our social batteries and our attention spans are changing as well. And that's not because people are ADHD, or that's not because, you know, that I feel in my bones is becoming a universal truth, that there's just that shift is happening. But I do, I think partly because I'm a bit older now, and therefore I know myself a bit more. I know what I like and what I don't like, and I'm quite happy to say what I like and I don't like, and I do and don't agree with. I think I'm much clearer on my boundaries in terms of I don't work weekends and I don't work evenings, and I don't tend to have meetings before midday, and I try not to make big decisions in the afternoon, and we don't do any internal email. I mean, we haven't done for 10 years. And so just some of these ways of working,
yeah,
that I realize suit my brain and suit my working style. And then being able to kind of model that clarity for my team becomes, I think, is where the magic really starts, because we've got a small charity team, everybody's neurodivergent, and we've got a small drinks team, and most people are neurodivergent. And so that becomes a, yeah, hopefully when you've got kind of leadership asking you, how do you best like to work? How do you like to receive information? When's your brain at its best? All that sort of stuff. Yeah, it just makes for, my hope anyway, is clarity and just great performance, that people are able to be at their best because they feel safe and they feel empowered. And that's got nothing to do with kind of capability or skill set. That's Luke Bearden is this amazing, he doesn't like being called an expert, even though he's worked in autism for 30 years and teaches like a postgraduate course on it, and has written 9 books on it.
He might say expert.
Yeah, he doesn't like to be called an expert. He has, and he's a brilliant, brilliant man and a brilliant speaker. And he was telling me about this golden equation he has, which is autism plus environment equals outcome.
Mm.
And so put me in the right environment and I can thrive, and put me in the wrong environment and I cannot. And that equation, I think, is true across so many different, not just autism, but in the workplace, you know, for kids at school, and anybody whose brain works a bit differently. I think the environment is huge, and you're trying to create the conditions where people can thrive. And that's, I guess, what I'm trying to do with my teams by sort of modeling how it works for me, or how I can be at my best. So that you get that reciprocal piece of, oh, it's okay to do it a different way. Okay, great. Actually, Phoebe really likes voice notes. She really likes voice notes. She reads the transcription and she can hear the voice note. And that is the best way I can deliver information to Phoebe. Great. I know that. I don't have to think about that every time. But I know that works really well. And I know Kristen and I have lots of phone calls, And that's great because I love a phone call. So we're not a huge company, Rich. So it's a real luxury to be able to tailor everything and have everything so individual. But all in service of, if people are happy, safe, empowered at work, they're going to do better work. And that's a win-win.
Well, there we go. And, one of the areas I love to get out from people on the podcast is about these amazing insights and wisdom. And then you're sharing so many of them there, but just how to create an environment for potentially 20%, maybe more, of your team who may know they are neurodivergent, may not know.
But yes.
Just the things that we can do. And I do appreciate there's a scale piece here, but I also think when it comes from what I'm getting, this profound care and kindness and very, very deliberate, intentional, you might say, about how you lead, then I think you can scale it up that way.
Yeah, I do. And I think empowering the team, that it should all sort of flow in and around and through, the company, the organization. So if there's a new joiner or, we're hiring a couple of people in the US at the moment. So that's, physically different because they're, on the other side of the world. I would hope that it is absolutely scalable because it's much more about kind of a work ethic and an attitude and obviously the culture and the kind of company or the kind of expectations that are set. And I think for anyone listening who's kind of like, well, I don't know if I am, or I don't know if my colleague is, or my boss is, or my manager, et cetera, or people in my team. I think that the number one thing, and I say this when parents ask me what they should do about their children who are neurodivergent or their partners, I think this is my one thing that seems to work across it all is curiosity. And it's not about asking direct judgment kind of questions. It is about jumping into their world, and it is about being curious about their brain. And 3 years ago or 4 years ago, I would never have said the words, "I love your brain." And I always say it to my guests, and I say it to my daughter. You can take away whether it's autism, ADHD, dyslexia. It doesn't need all those labels. And hear about how someone's brain works and be curious about how they see the world and how they process information. I do think that, curiosity goes a long way. And you do not need to be an expert in anything other than your daughter or your son or your spouse or your partner or your colleague or your team or your business. You don't need to know everything about autism or ADHD or dyslexia. I think there's a lot to be said for, being able to have conversations about this stuff where you don't even need to say things like ADHD. And we can, it's actually not as medical as we've been led to believe. It has been over pathologized.
Right.
And it's been over medicalized. And sure, there is medication for people for ADHDers if they so wish that can, that can really help. But actually, we're talking about a difference and we're talking about processing differences and sensory differences. We're not talking about diseases and deficiencies and disorders. I was born with this brain and I still have this brain and I will always have this brain. And I was born autistic and ADHD, and it took me 39 years to realize that.
And sort of sort of coming towards a bit of a close for the chat today, Ben, just to get, taking a bit of a, because you're very good at this, you know, we touched on it already, looking towards the future with that curiosity, with that sense of, I wonder what's coming. Thinking again, broad strokes about leadership. What does leadership need to be in the future?
God, I genuinely do not know the answer to that, Rich. I noticed that I've been exposed to, and we all have, lots of different kinds of leaders growing up, you know, parents, teachers, bosses, captains of teams, etc. Like there are loads of different leaders that we see. I was very good at sport. I was kind of made captain, you know, captain lots of teams, and I would get stuck in and I would lead from the front and I would kind of try and set an example, I guess. And that's certainly something that, I don't know, I that sort of has felt like it comes quite naturally to me without kind of it being deliberate. And I don't know what that says about me, but I think having kids has certainly put a new lens on leadership for me, of just, I am looked to, right? And kind of whether you're a natural leader or not, I am looked to by my children as to like which direction to go in life and what are we doing today? What do I think about something? And the same in terms of having a team. And so I kind of wear all that, actually most of the time quite heavily, in terms of pressure and responsibility that I bring on myself. But I really, to take it kind of down a notch, what I really want to, you know, I've got three daughters and I'm desperate to show them that men are kind and men tell the truth and men can support and men can be safe. And that's not because anything's happened to my daughters, but I don't know, in this kind of weird mixed up world, obviously masculinity and the role of a man is in lots of ways changing and shifting, and some of that is really bad and some of that actually is really good and really healthy. And I'm just acutely conscious that I find myself being quite ashamed to be a man at times, and feeling weird levels of guilt about being a man. And so I really want that to change, and I really want really good men to lead. And my daughters and my wife to have good men around them and good allies. And the same, I guess, within the workplace, that we need to be good allies and leaders should be good allies for lots of different reasons to lots of different kinds of people, not just from a gender perspective, but from a neuro-inclusivity perspective as well. Like we do need to, of course we need to lead, but we also need to be able to be an ally as well. Sorry, that was a very long answer, Rich.
No, I love that. Absolutely. Honestly, Ben, I know that we kind of sprung that on you. That's not prepared, but I think that's right from the heart, that share in terms of what's important and where you're putting your focus and your attention, being that ally, be it at home with your wife and your kids or in the workplace. And that's it. And if leadership is, it's about influence, essentially, and you're influencing all of us around us all of the time with that intentional approach. And I love that.
Yeah. Because I think that's an important part of being a human being. And I also think that's an important part of being a father and having responsibilities of children and of being a business owner and having responsibilities to a team there. So yeah, I that doesn't mean I'm not excited about the next sort of 10 years, but I think I'd love to be getting to the end of the next 10 years going, I'm really proud to be a man.
Yeah. Wow. I think there's a whole podcast series in there somewhere. we need that.
Oh, Ben.
I have loved this conversation. I loved it 5 years ago. I loved it today. Let's not leave it another 5 years. We'll talk again. But great to see you, Ben. Really appreciate you coming on the Mojo podcast today.
Thank you for having me.